And our sermon text for this second Sunday in Lent, Matthew 26, 69 to 75. Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, "You also were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. What is the most afraid that you've ever been? Bringing home that report card? Asking that little blonde girl for a date when you were just a teenager? Maybe battle. As I reflect on my son John and his career. In homeschool, we read Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. And he captures this sense of complete bone-rattling, abject fear in the face of imminent death. Crane's young Union soldier, in his first battle amidst the din and smoke and blood and noise, Crane says, "yelled with fright and swung about. For a moment in the great clamor, he was like a proverbial chicken." Having chickens on our farm and seeing them run when they're afraid, what an image, right? Crane goes on to say, "he lost the direction of safety. Destruction threatened him from all points. Directly he began to speed toward the rear in great leaps. His rifle and cap were gone. His unbuttoned coat bulged in the wind. The flap of his cartridge box bobbled wildly, and his canteen by its slender cord swung out behind. On his face was all the horror of those things which he imagined." Fear like this drives you to heights of physical tolerance to pain, as well as tolerance for the conscience, too. The conscience to say and do anything to get you out of danger. Crane says, "he ran like a blind man. Two or three times he fell down. Once he knocked his shoulder so heavily against a tree that he went headlong. Since he had turned his back upon the fight, his fears had been wondrously magnified." Crane's book is a classic for good reason. He goes on to paint one of the most convincing portraits of fear and cowardice and remorse and redemption as well in American literature. It's worth reading again. And the setting of the Civil War is most apt, too, since casualties were so high, death was so near. But if we consider it rightly, there's another portrait of fear and cowardice and remorse and redemption, too, that far transcends the red badge of courage. It's the denial, the remorse, the repentance, and restoration of the Apostle Peter. It's no exaggeration either, since Peter faced far more than imminent physical death. And I want you to get a flavor and a taste for this, too. Because before him lay the rejection and judgment by his own people, the unimaginable suffering that was about to fall upon his master, such that he had seen with his own eyes Jesus pale with fear himself, consumed with such dread that he sweated, as it were, great drops of blood. What must it be that drives the Lord to such dread and despair? Can a mere man bear these things? Of course, we have to say no. A mere man cannot bear these things. In our look at the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth, we opened with why it was necessary that the Redemptor of mankind be divine. We're beginning to come up against this here as he faces the cross. A mere man must run and dodge and flee, even lie through his teeth if necessary. But no man should die a death like this that's coming. There's a sense of foreboding and darkness and horror that is coming upon our narrative. And you must have a sense for this. Taken cumulatively with all of the Gospels, this sense of foreboding and horror is coming upon our scene. Whatever thoughts ran through Peter's mind in these moments, he's utterly crushed by them. So far from being what they were when he conceived them that he cannot even recall them now. Now all he can think of is saving his own skin, even if he has to deny his own Lord. Denial. Let's examine our text today because it says something collectively about human nature and thus about us. Lest we preen and pride ourselves, that certainly if it had been us, or if it had been me, we would not have denied him, though all others desert him. These words ring a bell, maybe, of remembrance, huh? As you read the Gospels. Let's go on to our text today and look at this denial, this narrative of denial. Three superlative stages Peter goes through. Verses 69 and 70, for example, in a consummate picture of great self-delusion and depravity. And don't underestimate the self-delusion and depravity of this narrative. The titular leader of the 12 denies his very Lord a first time. Now we engage the passion narrative of Matthew here. We could have started more extensively, perhaps, at the supper. If I'd been here last week, we would have treated the trial by the Sanhedrin of Jesus. But we engage the narrative of Christ's crucifixion here at Peter's denial. And Matthew takes up Peter's denial at a very apt juncture in the passion narrative, too. Jesus has just been convicted of blasphemy by the religious leaders of the nation who violated every biblical principle of justice in doing this. And not that only, but the excruciating and humiliating blows of scorn passed upon him by these same august, respected men of the community, behaving like dancing demons in the night, these so-called religious leaders of Israel. So you get a sense for the darkness and chaos that is descending here upon this scene that will only get worse as the crucifixion obtains. Peter now in the midst of this, if this is merely phase one of judgment, what is yet to come? Will Christ be dragged before some Gentile or other as well? There's no chance that he'll be merely beaten and released. Death is certain. What then of a disciple? Will not they treat him in the same fashion? Didn't the master on more than one occasion, this was probably a regular theme in his life, a servant is not greater than his master. They persecuted me, they will also persecute you. But even so, Peter does have at least enough courage to tail Jesus into the courtyard of Caiaphas. This is the scene of his denial. Whereas John's account describes, we'll be looking collectively at the accounts here too. I'll be adding details from the other Gospels here to Peter's denial. John tells us that Peter was admitted by a servant girl at the behest of John, who was familiar to the priestly family of Caiaphas and was present as well, even at the foot of the cross. So, swept along by events, Peter now found himself in the midst of a group of servants around a charcoal brazier, warming themselves, since it was cold, even in the spring there. We know about that in Idaho, don't we? Cold springs. It is in the light of this fire that Peter is surprised by a half-curious, half-accusatory observation. This comes through in the Greek. By the very same servant girl who admitted him. You also were with Jesus the Galilean. It's not a question, but an assertion. It is a matter-of-fact observation from someone who knows what her eyes have seen. So, the ruse is over. Peter's uneasy anonymity is over. He risked being spotted and recognized, and then now the only thing is to play it at the level of ignorance. I do not know what you mean. Literally, I don't know what you're saying. Even in the original language, it's a lame and half-hearted utterance. Of course, he knows precisely what she's saying. Furthermore, he knows that she is right. Fear drives you to consternation and foolishness, doesn't it? Even if he was not of the band, it would have been impossible for him not to have known of what she spoke, since not only was Jerusalem full of this matter, but no one would have been privy to these proceedings and precincts without general knowledge of Jesus. The issues at stake, plenty enough context to know exactly what she meant by you also were with Jesus. So for Peter to say, I don't know what you're saying, is on its face a bold-faced lie. Anyone with even a rudimentary skill at lie detection would have seen it immediately. How unlike Peter. Peter's half-baked denial is indicative of his predicament. No longer is he in the safe confines of the upper room or the crowded temple courtyards, surrounded by the people, being part of the upstart band of disciples whose master vanquished every comer, parried every question. Now the tables are turned. Then it seemed only natural and right to declare, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. Not only are, as one wag puts it, the absent always wrong, but in Peter's case, they're also dead. Like a little kid who plays war with his toy soldiers in the safety of his bedroom, I'm always victorious. The other guy's always dead, and I'm always the hero. So it is that Peter, in the zeal of the moment in the upper room when Jesus predicts this very moment, is a legend in his own mind, isn't he? Of course, then he cannot see how he, the one who confessed him Lord, the one who spoke first and acted first, even drawing a sword to slice off the ear of Malchus in the garden, could not see how. He would not only refuse to go to death with him, but also shamefully deny him. Not even give a verbal defense, much less a physical one. Inconceivable to Peter in the upper room, in the courtyard. Confessing him. But of course, this was pre-Gethsemane, pre-arrest, pre-trial. Get a sense for the atmosphere, for the ambiance of crucifixion. Because now a supernatural set of circumstances, and you must understand this indeed, as God is about to pour out his wrath for the sin of all of us upon his Son. All of the Gospels, and collectively, we get a sense for that supernatural set of circumstances beginning to obtain, turned over everything that Peter has known and understood, too, as this premonition comes upon him. The hatred and the violence he had seen in the eyes of these men in the garden. And then to see one of their own, how that must have broken not only Jesus, but also his disciples, to see Judas, of all people, filled with the palpable presence of Satan. You see the supernatural set of circumstances beginning to obtain. Leading the barely controlled mob that invaded the sanctity of the garden, where they had met continuously throughout his ministry, there to arrest him. What a shock and a wonder and a horror it must have been. The beautiful order of the supper so quickly and unexpectedly descended into chaos and disorder, such that a dread of all things seemed to hang over the whole proceedings. This was nothing like any of them had seen in his entire ministry. A pall seemed to overhang everything like a dense film of smoke. Indeed, God will manifest his theophanic presence in their midst soon. Collectively, we see in darkness and earthquake and smoke and thunder, even as he visits his judgment upon his beloved son for the sin of his people. He'll descend upon a mount once more, the Mount of Golgotha, in order to judge the sins of his people in his son. How terrible and how awful. Who would want to be a part of that? The veil between heaven and earth, earth and hell, very thin at this juncture. Who, when he signed up to be a disciple, and furthermore, went on a limb, blurted out, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you," would have thought that this is what Jesus meant. Not a mere mortal death, but a death filled with the ominous portent of God himself in vehemence and wrath. There was something different approaching. Something Peter had not bargained for. Something that terrified him to his inner core so that he dissolved in fear. Remember, the presence of God, whenever manifest, drives men to say with Isaiah, "I am dissolving in my being." It is these kinds of things that make a man forget all else, that make him abandon all his fine promises, his good intentions. So make no mistake about this. Peter faced not just the ordinary death of a mere mortal, bad enough, but he sensed also in this, though not as clearly and distinctly as he would after the resurrection and ascension of Jesus, but he also sensed in Jesus' death something far more dreadful and profound. He saw it prefigured and anticipated by Jesus himself in the Garden of Gethsemane, but now also in the arrest and trial. As the noose begins to tighten, the elemental and existential dread he now feared, though he could never endure what Jesus was about to endure. Even so, even though Peter could never die a substitutionary death for mankind, he did not even want to be in the area of one who did. Just as no one of us would want to be in this region when Yellowstone blows. Oh, when we see an atom bomb explode. Well, so Peter had a fear of death that transcends the ordinary. Thus his feeble, "I don't know what you're saying." So, this of course is satisfactory, isn't it? For everybody around him, that little fire that night? Or is it? How deep does this denial go? Brings us to point two, verses 69 and 70. Denial in a consummate picture of greater self-delusion and depravity. The titular leader of the 12 denies his very Lord a second time. A second time. If Peter had thought to remain incognito. He wasn't going to do so by the fire anymore, right? Whether uncomfortable with his confession or whether he was just uneasy and in need of nervous pacing, he moves off from the fire towards the entrance of the courtyard. And it's here that he is spotted by yet someone else who recognizes him. Drat! Right? He wanted to be there to observe, but not be noticed. Even moving off from the light of the fire was not enough. Being the de facto leader of the 12, while perhaps having its perks and advantages, now presented a problem. Another servant had spotted him. Did not bargain for this. Think of other traitors. Benedict Arnold, for example. How great it is to be the commander, to be an officer, and on Commander Washington's general staff until the war starts. And now you are marked and a hunted man. Benedict Arnold never received the plaudits and credits he thought he deserved. The war did not go as he thought it would go for himself. The noose is beginning to tighten now, and Peter is beginning to feel the pressure. And already we know what would have been apparent to any other casually informed Jew. Two witnesses had come forward now. They have identified Peter as a co-conspirator with his unorthodox rabbi. Two witnesses had been drummed up against Jesus, too. Certainly two more sworn witnesses could be found for this guy. Blood was in the water. If the sharks wanted to feed, additionally, another victim was available. If the clamor would be raised, he would be a goner. And so Peter raises the stakes in this game of redemptive poker. He swears an oath to his truthfulness. A false oath. To do so, to swear an oath as to the truthfulness of one's testimony, was to call God as a witness to it. It was solemn and it was binding. For example, all through the Pentateuch, but here at Leviticus 19 in particular, you shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Thus, Peter has compounded his previous false witness with a false binding oath. Certainly the pressure was great, the danger real, the fear of death was palpable, and Peter was unprepared. While we have no indication that Peter remembered Jesus' warning, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation, just in the garden earlier that night. We certainly do, right? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. Even though we see with 20/20 hindsight and the safety and comfort of 2,000 years between us, Peter's prayerlessness is manifest in his pitiful performance now. He's under pressure, ominous, portentous pressure, pressure he had never thought he would face, supernatural, transcendent pressure. He may have been nearest Jesus in the garden as the master prayed, but he was far from being a prayed up, spiritually prepared man now. Instead, with every new accusation, Peter regresses further and further into sin and depravity, compounding his sin. If, as John points out in his letter, fear has to do with judgment, right? Fear has to do with judgment, then Peter here fears the judgment of men. And if perfect love casts out fear, then Peter has not yet love completed in him, for he fears greatly. How could Peter do this? How could someone so reputedly strong and impetuous be so hesitant and cowardly now? How could the man who so boldly and confidently confessed you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, before God and man now so wimpishly, feebly swear an oath to the truthfulness of his denial of that same Christ? One confession so believable and certain, this one so incredible and utterly deniable, right? Nobody there believed him. Well, you and I, brothers and sisters, of course, we would have behaved differently had it been us. Just the attitude Peter had brought into it. Do not underestimate the boldness of the human heart towards self-delusion and depravity. In moments of daylight and exposure to the Word of God, times like this, we clearly see that we would have performed at least equally as bad as Peter, right? If not much worse. We might have gone screaming from the courtyard like panicked children. I thought of this when I was in Florida with my grandkids, walking with my little granddaughter Hannah, who's very strong-willed and impetuous herself. I don't know where she gets that. Following her nose down the beach, picking up shells and stones and stuff. Hannah, don't go so far ahead of Grandpa, right? So she finally found herself in the midst of this beautiful Spanish family that were just inviting her to join them and stuff and playing with her. She all of a sudden looked up, Mommy! And she went screaming, hands flailing, where's Mommy? Right? That's what we would have been like, I fear. That's what I thought of that immediately. Yet Peter, here, we might have fled like that young soldier if we'd had the guts to enter the lion's den in the first place, as Peter did. But in our more private moments of self-flattery and delusion, we perhaps whisper secretly to ourselves, though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Even with 20/20 hindsight, the human heart drifts towards self-delusion and depravity and self-flattery. So don't fool yourself. Do not be deceived, listener. What you see in depraved Peter, see in your own heart. If that's the case, what do we see in our last vignette then? Certainly the first apostle is the first to see the error of his ways, right? Certainly he brings himself up short to redeem his actions, does he? Let's look at point 3, verses 73 to 75. Denial, in a consummate picture of greatest self-delusion and depravity, the titular leader of the 12 denies his very Lord a third time. Luke, in his gospel, marks off the interval of time to Peter's third denial at about an hour. Whatever transpired in that period, a group of those gathered. Now, a group, a mob beginning to form, right? A group of those gathered in the courtyard, that is one's standing, found it timely to confront Peter with a consensus judgment of the group that he was obviously one of the band of disciples. They weren't going to let it drop. See, the foreboding, the intimidation. No longer was it a stray servant girl confronting Peter, but an informal caucus of those who had something to do with Caiaphas and his household and office, too. That's the context of our study. It'd be a simple matter to sound an alarm and have him seized for questioning, if for no other reason. After all, he seemed so eager to deny his affiliation that he only raised rather than quelled suspicions by them. Additionally, it's a nice little cultural digression here. They're curious about a fact glaringly, gratingly apparent to the ear of everyone there. Peter's speech is marked by the distinctive, irritating burr of a Galilean. It was an accent that no educated, refined Jew employed in the temple or synagogue, if at all possible. The smooth Judean accent was the patois of temple, synagogue, and seat at the gate. The Galilean accent was the accent of the Rube and the hillbilly, such that the rabbis made it a rule. This is a rabbinical rule we know from the Mishnah. No Galilean shall pronounce the benediction in the synagogue service. It was an accent you lost as soon as practicable, even as the refined and educated try and lose their heavy southern drawls or their Chicago twangs. Our first Sunday in Chicago, we visited a church. The pastor began his prayer, "Dear God," I said, "Lord, please." When our son John began to adopt a Chicago accent, we said, "We got to move. Let's get out of here." How intimidating this scene must have been to Peter. This informal grand jury was prepared to indict him. They had been accumulating their evidence and were, if nothing else, yanking his chain to see his reaction. Peter was now a cornered animal, Galilean prey that these Judean bystanders were determined to play with before consuming. The night was swiftly passing. Dawn was approaching. Yet there was still time to haul any stray disciples, especially one as brash and as outspoken as Peter, before the Sanhedrin. It would be just as easy to prepare two crosses as one. With this kind of scenario developing before his eyes, he was not yet in the clear. Peter reacts with what would be the equivalent schoolyard double dog dare. He began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I don't know the man." And the tense of that Greek verb means he didn't do it just once, but continuously, to try and drive the point home. Peter has ramped up the stakes by, in addition to swearing before God that he does not know the man. How cold, how impersonal this term for the dear master he knew intimately by name. But he also now calls down curses on his head if indeed he is swearing falsely. It's time to stand back from this man, for it'd be entirely just for God himself to strike Peter dead then and there where he stands with a big blue bolt of lightning, wouldn't it? Peter's big mouth has flapped him into a spiritual and personal corner. He has so boldly, unequivocally, proudly declared that he would never deny his Lord. Nay, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And now, with equal boldness and definitiveness, Peter has just done that very thing. Deny that he even knew the man. With this impending, abject horror approaching, the presence of God to punish sin fully and finally, crucifixion. Who thought that that kind of death was in store? All the stops must be pulled to avoid this. Commandments, shamanments. I'll break 11 commandments if it means I avoid crucifixion with this guy. I will curse my mother's grave if it means I escape the cursed death of the cross. No way, Jose. If it means I avoid indictment by this vigilante grand jury by cursing and lying, then so be it. I will invoke curses on my head and lie through my teeth. What do you want me to say? Just don't prepare a cross for me, right? Peter needed no waterboarding, did he, to do this? The third time is a charm. It's early morning. The night of Peter's probation is over. The cock crows. Luke tells us that Jesus' gaze, in his inimitable way, right? Luke tells us that Jesus' gaze connects with Peter, and all becomes clear to Peter. He's not the brave, faithful disciple of his own imagination. Rather, he's the craven, frightened, whipped puppy that he so despises. The floodgate of memory flings open. He remembers the words of his Lord, "Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times." Suddenly, his proud ego structure collapses. He realizes he's not the man he flattered himself to be. Isn't that just like sinners, all of us? The hero is the villain. The courageous is a coward. The faithful one is, after all, faithless. Matthew has Peter skulking out of the courtyard, weeping bitterly. My Greek exegesis professor, Donald Carson, remarks, Matthew does not mention Peter again. John has the story of his redemption. Matthew has no use for him the rest of the gospel. We must not take the edge off of this narrative. Although Peter will be restored, as John's gospel details, for the remainder of the passion into the resurrection, Peter is absent. He's a non-factor. Yet there is a purpose in this too. We are meant to contrast Jesus to Peter, the divine from the fallen human. Jesus has three faithful, intense moments of prayer, and they contrast with Peter's three lackadaisical hours of prayer. Jesus is faithful, Peter is not. Jesus has three faithful witnesses, doesn't he, before three false tribunals, Caiaphas's, Herod's, and Pilate's. Contrast this with Peter's three denials just before you. Jesus is faithful, Peter is not. The divine is faithful, the fallen human is not. No human could have borne then what Christ is about to bear. Our gospel narrative illumines for us the unmistakable divine nature and character of Jesus. There's only one who is able to bear the terrible, infinite weight of judgment about to fall, impending at the very threshold. It's palpable. The Gospels make it palpable to us if we are reading. The Lord himself trembled in the garden at the prospect of this next day. What else made Jesus do this? A wake-up call to Peter. What is coming if my Lord indeed is sweating great drops of blood in fear? The sophisticated, restrained, powerful men of the Sanhedrin are already behaving like animals, tasting blood, slapping, beating, mocking the Prince of Peace. Their lackeys also yelping concerning a disciple and sporting with him. Something awful is about to happen. Something that has not been equaled since that day in the Garden of Eden so long ago. There will be a judgment again, a test again, a probation again. We are meant to gather from the evidence of Peter's denial that all others, no matter their pretension, no matter their vaunted strength, no matter their infinite capacity for self-flattery, they will collapse and fall like a cheap lawn chair when the least pressure that this one must be faced, that this one must face, is applied to them. It would have been the same with us. In their weakness, they will vanish like an evaporating mist. Jesus alone is strong to save. He alone will stand when the dust of death clears. what is coming. How despairing it must have been. The Lord of glory now covered with blood, destined to be so bloodied and beaten to a pulp, as Isaiah says, he will be unrecognizable as a man. He is the only one in the universe, in the history of the seed of man. We've seen this from his birth when we discover that he is divine. The only one in the history of the seed of man, as the genealogists tell us, who is capable of bearing the weight from heaven and earth that is about to fall. It will be a mantle of iron. It will be a burden incapable to bear, unless it is this one, the Christ, your Lord. So make no mistake about it, Christian, it was true then with your redemption, and it's true now with whatever it is you bear as well, brothers and sisters. So whatever it is you bear, bring it to him, because he's born much, much more. Well, let us now come to that place then where we find restoration for brokenness and defeat, where we find in the bread and cup the nourishment which will heal and restore us. Let us come to the table of the Lord in the Lord's Supper.